And that takes us to 7:35 in the morning. The program's up front. My name is Brian Edwards Teeger. Move now to the congressional session ahead, where Democrats, particularly incoming freshmen, are trying to stake out the issues that will be the defining policy fights of the year and years to come. And all eyes have been on incoming self-described Democratic Socialist Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who has been making her signature issue in recent weeks something called a Green New Deal. Here she is at a climate town hall convened in Washington, D.C. earlier this month by Bernie Sanders.
This is going to be the great society, the moonshot, the civil rights movement of our generation. That is the scale. That is the scale of the ambition that this movement is going to require.
Democrats in both the House and Senate have been tripping over themselves to sign up as supporters of the Green New Deal. But it is a policy that has not been elaborated in very great detail yet, because it is not something that is coming out of the traditional Washington, D.C. think tank circle. So we thought we would take a significant amount of time to talk about what the concept of a Green New Deal is, how that is different from what Democrats have championed by way of climate legislation in the past, if everybody means the same thing when they talk about a Green New Deal, and what the debates are to come among the people who support at least the political brand. Joining us to wade through the thicket is Greg Carlick. He's a senior advisor to the new think tank Data for Progress. He's a lead author on a report that they released in September called A Green New Deal, A Progressive Vision for Environmental Sustainability and Economic Stability. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first,
excited to be here to talk about this.
Why don't you give me your elevator pitch? As a policy, what is a Green New Deal? How is it distinct from what's been tried before?
Yeah, I think what's truly distinct about it is it's really trying to meet the policy priorities on the economic side and the job side, which we view are greatly tied to the environmental issues, where a lot of the problems on the environmental side are caused by an economic system. And a lot of the solutions require pointing the economy at the problem. And so if they're intrinsically tied, then the solutions should be as well. And really the elevator pitch of like, what is a Green New Deal? You mentioned it can mean different things to different people. And I'm perfectly okay with that, because the problems that people face and the solutions that people will try will be different. But under the umbrella vision, it's recognizing, one, the need. I think that that's core for us to understand not only the economic transformation, but as Representative elect Ocasio-Cortez said in that excerpt there, this is a huge problem. It is a global problem. It is a crisis. And we have to kind of meet that crisis with high ambition. And then the second thing is the vision is really about laying out, at least what I put forth, is what this could look like, right? It's laying about some policy vision pieces around a low carbon, no carbon economy, clean air and clean water, and actually kind of finishing the job there that we've started for over 50, 70 years now in those spaces, restoring the American landscape, which so many people rely on, and urban and rural resilience, because we also have to deal with the climate impacts. And so just kind of underscoring the need as well as underscoring where are the priority areas for a Green New Deal.
I went through your report, 22 different bullet-pointed policy initiatives. Don't you have some concern that if you go in with a laundry list, then the political system gets to cherry pick them, and maybe what you walk out with is just a subsidy for corn ethanol?
I hope not. That's not what comes out the other side. But a lot of people actually have true concerns there. And you know, you mentioned at the top of this about how this is not coming out of some of those standard DC think tanks, or this is kind of coming out from far left, pun intended, because they don't want it to go through the same systems, the same processes, to make sure that it's not just not only a half measure, but something that goes towards subsidizing corporate interests or existing power structures. And so recognizing that it needs to be different from the onset. So you can look at the resolution for the new committee was trying to do something a bit different in kind of the parliamentary procedural processes. And then also, you know, some important thread underpinning the Green New Deal is this emphasis on justice from the beginning. That doesn't just hark back to history, where the original New Deal under President FDR left so many communities behind and created institutionalized structural racism and injustices. And so we need to be thoughtful of that. You know, we need to correct those, but we also need to be thoughtful of that and engage on that from the front end. And then the other thing I'll say, just on that question about, you know, a laundry list, I don't think it can be one package, right? I think it has to be incremental. I think we have to break this up into the pieces and deal with the constituencies and the issues, but not losing sight of the whole forest.
The central policy feature that a lot of people have talked about and that your organization, Data for Progress, has specifically pulled on is what you're calling a green jobs guarantee. According to your poll, 40% of the public seriously supports the concept when it's explained to them. 42% somewhat support it. You're making the case that this is basically consensus politics among the public at large. It seems like a weird time to be talking about job guarantees. I mean, unemployment's at an almost historic low. When the original New Deal proposed concepts like the Works Progress Administration, the Civilian Conservation Corps, almost a quarter of the working age population was out of work. It's almost opposite circumstances, isn't it?
I disagree, just because one of the core elements of a progressive agenda is about not just whether or not you have a job, but whether it's a decent job. And fundamental to the Green New Deal and the progressive agenda is redefining a decent job. And so those include things like full-time work, not minimum wage, but a living wage or a union wage, benefits, healthcare benefits, sick leave, some sort of retirement at the end of that road. And so, sure, unemployment is low, historically low, in some respects. But looking at wage stagnation, access to benefits and healthcare, despite what the ACA has done for this country, people still look at the jobs are not as good as they used to be, at what came out of kind of the post-war era and the increasing of unionization that really redefined in that era what a good job is. And we've lost that definition, and it's increasingly getting worse. And so that low unemployment really means that people have to work more than they necessarily would want to. But they're not making the living that they want to.
What's the specific policy path to creating a green jobs guarantee? Is it a la the original New Deal, setting up arms of government that actually hire people to do work? Is it farming money out to nonprofits? Is it subsidies? Like, what specifically does it mean?
So all the above is kind of the way I've been looking at it right now, which is, I mean, it's a big country, right? We're not a small country where you can kind of centralize a lot of this stuff. So not only our constitutional structure, but just the sheer size and the relationship with states. So there are other folks who have looked very deeply at the job guarantee element and just kind of touching on that concept.
But, you know, a central feature of the jobs guarantee programs in the original New Deal was also to try to kind of knit the country together, like to take unemployed young men, and it was men, out of the cities and send them to more remote parts of the country to work on infrastructure in national parks. It was as much a program of building national unity as putting people back to work.
I 100% agree with that, you know, and the framing that FDR took in that sense with the direct employment of folks around a national mission. I think that there's a spirit there that we would want to replicate in the Green New Deal. But the job guarantee, the nuance there of what's the difference between direct hiring and a guarantee? There's kind of a nuance on labor policy I won't get into because I'm also not an expert in it, but it is about creating opportunities where people... It's an entitlement where if you come to, let's just call it Organization A for right now, and say, I want a job, that there's a job waiting for you with all the benefits that we want. Now, how that can be implemented, if you look at what Senator Booker has put out in a bill that would look at a pilot system to explore, you know, at a small scale first, how might this play out? There's research that's been done, colleagues that I have, that look at, as you mentioned, funneling funds through nonprofits with similar kind of labor job standards. to funnel money into the communities. And then there's, you know, workforce training and redeployment things, so that is kind of stimulating re-education. And there could be direct hiring, and whether or not there's programs, as you said, as the details get fleshed out about what specific transformation, if it's infrastructure, if it's, you know, like thinking back in the New Deal era, the replanting of forests and restoring the Midwest for agriculture. You know, those were large, those required a lot of manpower, labor, human labor. So direct employment was the case there.
Well, speaking of Greg Carlick, he is a senior advisor to Data for Progress, relatively new think tank that has racked up a fairly impressive track record so far at shifting the bounds of political discourse in Washington, D.C. If you've heard of the concept of abolishing ICE, and you have heard it in the context of a congressional campaign, that is largely because of the efforts of that organization's founder, Sean McElwee. Greg is the lead author of their new policy report entitled A Green New Deal, A Progressive Vision for Environmental Sustainability and Economic Stability. There's a kind of bigger global question I want to raise, and I want to attack this. Yeah, let's take the big picture question first. There's a big swath of the environmental movement and some people in economics on the left who think that, or who argue that, economic growth is fundamentally at odds with environmental sustainability and reining in climate change. And you can't be an economic growth booster, as the Green New Deal purports to be, without also upping carbon emissions. And they have basically moved in tandem through human history so far.
Yeah, I think that that is a huge misconception that, that we want to tackle. I mean, the concept back in the day, they were calling it green growth, right? That you could still grow without concerning your, you know, taking into consideration the environmental impact. I mean, just on the fiscal policy side of it, a Green New Deal is a stimulus. It is an injection of federal spending and public spending into solve this problem. And so that will grow the economy. And the goal is to use that policymaking to say, where do we want to grow? Where do we want to invest it? You know, something like a tax cut, the most recent tax cuts, you know, that puts it in the hands of the wealthy. Does that generate the growth and the other indicators we want? There's an argument. Similarly, with in injecting that in wars, this is a choice of injecting in communities into new jobs, into new fields. The other thing there about growing emissions, you know, at a global level, yeah, there's a lot of countries who are trying to kind of reach that level of wealth and affluence and development as the United States. And many of them have not peaked in terms of their global emissions. And so bringing that kind of Green New Deal about direct investment into low carbon, you know, they are kind of worried about growth, or more focused on that growth element. But in the United States, we have really seen a decoupling of carbon intensity of GDP, where the types of economic activity, the service industries, the IT industries, just kind of these virtual services, have reduced the carbon intensity of a lot of what we're doing. And we're really trying to get to the remainder of that and bring that carbon intensity down to zero.
Yeah, but there's a difference between not having like industrial smokestacks within the bounds of the United States and not being part of a carbonized economy. If we're buying our carbon intensive products from Asia and their factories are polluted and being powered by coal-fired power plants, we still have a carbon footprint. It's just not showing up in our emissions tracking.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's an economic leakage where our consumptive behavior is really reflected somewhere else and not in our national accounting. And there's new ways of kind of estimating that. I know Europe has taken the lead on trying to get a sense of their consumption-based greenhouse gas emissions. And that's where we really have to look at the leadership of around the Paris Agreement and the UN UNFCCC Climate Change Commission processes. Because that's the only way we're going to get the global leadership to have all the countries agreeing to how they are going to peak their emissions and draw them down. And that starts at home. I mean, that certainly starts at home as the United States demonstrating that it can decarbonize its economy, and then dealing with those transboundary issues additionally.
Greg Carlick, I want to now hold this up in contrast to prior approaches by Democrats to dealing with climate legislation. Almost all efforts since the dawn of the Obama administration have been built around a framework of increasing the cost of polluting, generally through a cap and trade form of imposing that cost that would let polluters trade permission to pollute so as to find the most cost-effective means of reducing it. This is approaching the problem from a dramatically different angle. There's no discussion whatsoever in your white paper of carbon pricing.
There's one bullet, and it's super buried. So don't blame me for not seeing it. But you're right, right? And so in two regards there, just commenting on the cap and trade or the cap and dividend or some of these other mechanisms. You know, they harp back to a pollutant market-based mechanism back in the Montreal Protocol dealing with ozone-depleting things. And this was something that worked exceedingly well in its context in its era and continues to do so in some regards. But we're having a lot of substitutes that are also bad for other reasons, right? And so that model has been applied to carbon at a federal level. It's been attempted, right? If you look back to about 10 years ago with the Waxman-Markey concept about that. But there's also regional approaches. So the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative on the East Coast with quite a number of states. You also have one on the West Coast in California. And they show some promise about state-level commitments to kind of trade credits and reduce their emissions over time. Where that's kind of different right now is I think there's kind of two aspects. One is whether or not a market-based mechanism can reduce things fast enough and whether or not the costs and the benefits are carried, you know, equitably across communities and whether or not those kinds of considerations are baked in. The second is the... Well, I forgot the second one, but the key to the Green New Deal is really separating also the spending versus the revenue generating. At the federal level, we fundamentally believe you don't have to raise the revenue to spend. This is fiscal and monetary policy that we've been operating under for ever since we got off the gold standard. It's a different picture at the state and local levels where they do have to generate revenues to fund their government. But at the federal level, we don't. And so taxing polluters, taxing pollution, taxing carbon is a technique in order to draw down and change the market incentives. But they really, a lot of the concerns are, is that those are punitive on consumers if they're not handled well. Like if you look at what's going on in France, this is a carbon tax situation where the design did not take into those considerations. Even though the citizens want the transformation, you're seeing that they don't want to pay, they don't want to feel like that they have to bear the full price. So design is really important there. And so that's where you're seeing less focus in our context about the specifics about market-based approaches and more about to meet the scale and urgency of the problem, we need to really invest in the transformation. We have to kind of get over the market-based as the whole solution or the, you know, leaning forward with the carbon tax first, and then here's what we do with it. It's carbon tax can be a component under certain circumstances and good design to handle short-term market disruptions that affect people. But we need to invest public investment, large-scale investment to get off carbon.
Going through the specifics of some of the bullets in your report, some of them rest on currently non-existent technologies. It talks about carbon-free aviation.
So some of that innovation is beginning, right? I mean, there's definitely an underscore of we need some massive innovation. There is a large chunk of the apple that we can do with existing technology that's either already at a reasonable scale that we can use it or exists at a marketable scale, but we just need to get it to scale, but it can be. And then there's other things that are still really in the demonstration. So if you're talking about something like transport related, you know, we already have electric vehicles for kind of passenger vehicles, light duty vehicles. getting those to scale, there's some engineering challenges that we have to deal with. They're sizable, but we can get there.
I get that. I think most of our listeners in California do, because there are a lot of electric cars on our roads. Scaling up something that's already existing and deployed is different from conjuring into existence something that is not deployed anywhere. Carbon-free aviation. I mean, my understanding is there is no energy source that is light and energy dense enough to keep a plane in the air other than petroleum-derived jet fuel.
So there is a new, if you're familiar with direct air capture, there is a company out in Europe that has figured out how to use direct air capture and through chemical processes create high-quality jet fuel. It is at a small scale right now, but it is what you would consider a net zero, so not a net negative. But it is a technology that exists, but not at a scale that could fully, obviously, replace aviation. And I think that is going to be, in terms of the transportation sector, the biggest challenge about how do you, what does an economy look like where we have such reduced air travel if we fundamentally don't have a replacement that can meet the scale of current aviation of air travel.
And then some of your bullets have been, are issues that have been controversial in environmental policy circles. Biofuel producer credits is one of them I alluded to earlier. There's a strong and well-substantiated argument at this point that the George W. Bush administration subsidies for corn ethanol, which is a biofuel, actually were a net negative for the climate because of the amount of carbon that was released as a consequence of land use changes and the refining process.
Yeah, it's 100% right about those additional unforeseen environmental implications of the ethanol and kind of the land use change associated with that when you create a market and you're kind of, shifting land uses to meet that productivity demand, and then that has a net negative.
By shifting land uses, we're talking about, among other things, mowing down the Amazon to backfill demand.
Right. That's a massive problem, and something that many colleagues I have that study that. And, within the United States, moving to more EV-based thing in terms of transportation, I think is where... let me kind of back up on that a little bit. I think in the United States, looking at the way in which ethanol is created and looking at more of the residues, kind of the agricultural residues that can be used, to whether or not that can supplement certain petroleum-based substitutions, because that is wasted biomass, as it were, and whether thinking more from a circular economy point of view of taking byproducts of the agricultural process and feeding them into some sort of system that can provide an economical substitute, getting to kind of what you're referencing, which is global biofuel demand that then creates incentives in Brazil to cut down their Amazons. There's a sense of leadership that the United States has to play in that. The role in which our economy results in the destruction of the world's biggest biomass carbon sink.
All right. Well, Greg Carlick, I really appreciate the work that you've done trying to put some meat on the bones of the political rhetoric around a Green New Deal and the time you've taken this morning to let us kick the tires on your work. Thanks for joining us.
I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Greg Carlick is a senior advisor to Data for Progress. They are a relatively new policy shop coming out of the left in the think tank spectrum. He is the lead author on their report, A Green New Deal, A Progressive Vision for Environmental Sustainability and Economic Stability.